Do you remember Rosa Parks, who refused to sit in the back of the bus? Yeah, back of the bus, you all know what that refers to. Well, unfortunately, there were some writings that, although the church decided to retain them in the canon, they were sent to the back of the canon. And these are the writings I'm talking about. And it's a challenge in some ways. Imagine I get to speak about the books called the Anti-Legomena. And those are the books, the general epistles. Hebrews, we don't even know who wrote it. James, 1st and 2nd Peter, and Jude. All of these books were spoken against. And so they're very important books for our topic, for our concern. And I want to speak about their authorship, and then as time permits, I'll go on and say a few other things about their view of Israel's future and the land. But it's very important that we address the question of authorship. I think they're in the wrong place in the canon. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not going to suggest we reopen the canon and start. I mean, we leave that to the Jesus seminar to do that. We're not going to start moving books around. But think about the logic of the New Testament. The New Testament begins rightly, of course, with the Gospels. And for Matthew to appear first is actually a very wise choice, given its obvious Jewish flavor, its engagement with the synagogue, just the way the very first verses begin, the genealogy and so on, the citation of Scripture as fulfilled. Matthew is a good place to begin the New Testament. And the book of Acts, where else can it go but after the four Gospels? But it is interesting that Paul has jumped the queue. Because if you look at the book of Acts, who are those first leaders? Isn't it Peter? And doesn't his leadership in Jerusalem pass then to James, the brother of Jesus? And then that's when we begin the transition to Paul. Paul doesn't really come to dominate the story in the book of Acts until chapter 13. And even then, James is still very much a force on into chapter 15 and beyond. And yet, when we look at the canon of the New Testament, we find the Gospels, the book of Acts, and then Paul's letters. And then crowded into the back, spoken against by many voices in the early church, are the writings that are the most overtly Jewish, but also writings that are speaking to Jewish believers. And that's why these writings are so important for our conference. So authorship is important. The Jewish authors will likely view the Jewish people, the land of Israel, and the future of Israel differently from the way non-Jewish authors will view them. Or even Paul, who of course is Jewish. Paul is very concerned that the Jesus story be explained and applied in Gentile settings. And that's why his letters are very important and have such a different complexion when we look at them. Let me begin with Hebrews, and along the way, I'll show you pictures of some of the papyri, because I'm going to make a point about the papyri, how important this witness is. One of the areas that I find very exciting in biblical studies in the last decade or so is the rediscovery of the importance of ancient manuscripts themselves as archaeological artifacts. They shed a lot of light. Sometimes they tell us how a text was interpreted. Some of you may have participated in the 2009 conference in Texas where we focused on Isaiah 53. You might recall how in my own presentation, which was on the epistles, I talked about how there was an interesting correlation between the punctuation and some sigla that we actually see in the margins of the great Isaiah scroll, as well as in the Aramaic paraphrase of Isaiah called the Targum. We noticed a correlation with exegesis in the New Testament itself, particularly with reference to Peter and Paul. And that's why these texts from antiquity don't just help us establish the text as an abstract as we strive in our study of the text to find out as closely as possible the wording of the autographs or the originals, but the texts themselves bear witness to how Scripture was studied and understood and what early Christians did with it. So let's talk about the authorship of Hebrews? Well, the early fathers rightly recognized that Paul was not the author. Even though in P46, a very important early collection of Paul's letters, Papyrus 46, probably dating to about 200 or 220, early 3rd century, Hebrews was included with Paul's letters, and that was a major endorsement for it and evidence of that in the early church. Interestingly enough, Tertullian recommended Barnabas as the author. You know, that was a very sensible suggestion. Now, it's pure speculation. We don't know of any testimony that would suggest that Barnabas really was the author apart from Tertullian's suggestion. As late as the 16th century, the great German reformer Martin Luther suggested that it was Apollos. And in fact, you can look at Luke Timothy Johnson's commentary, excellent commentary on Hebrews, and he will show you about a dozen points of correlation between what we know of Apollos on the one hand and the characteristics exhibited in Hebrews that would suggest that, you know, he is a good candidate. It would explain the Judaic character of this book. In fact, it would also explain Hebrews 13, verses 18 to 25. Those are the last few verses of the book of Hebrews, and every verse contains important parallels with Paul's letters. Have you ever wondered about that? I often, when I teach this course, that's where we begin. And so we take those last 7 or 8 verses and we go through line by line, and what we discover that with the exception of just a few words and phrases, we have parallels, many of them verbatim, with Paul's writings. But what does that mean, that Paul wrote Hebrews? No, because everything that precedes Hebrews 13, 18, that is Hebrews 1, 1 to 13, 17, all of that is very, very un-Paul. But the conclusion is a Christian way of speaking, and that's what I suggest. And so the author of Hebrews is part of the circle in which Paul the convert was nurtured in his new faith in Jesus. And so he adopted the Christian way of speaking, and that's what we see also in the part of the author of Hebrews. So all of us here could start speaking, and when we refer to certain things about the faith and extend blessings and so on to one another, the language could be very similar, even though the way we would then go on and write or speak in other settings could be very distinctive and very different. And I think that's what's going on here. Now, what about the Epistle of James? And here are some early manuscripts relating to James. The question of authorship here is very different. The name is given, so it's not anonymous as it is in the case of Hebrews. Hebrews just begins out of the blue. In a variety of ways, God spoke long ago to our fathers, and on he says, is speaking this way, but not with James. James just comes right out and identifies himself as James, a servant of the Lord. Well, who is this James, a servant of the Lord? That could apply to any believer in Jesus named James, but it's curious that the author does not find it necessary to identify himself further. The early church believed that the author of this letter was none other than the brother of Jesus. And it's been remarked, he's the only James with any kind of reasonable, even probable claim to the authorship of this letter. However, Eusebius, that very influential apologist and church historian, and there you see on the screen the reference in his ecclesiastical history, he rejects the authenticity of the letter. But he does acknowledge that it was widely read in the churches. And in fact, I've tracked that down, and James is alluded to or quoted in many early church fathers in the second century and, of course, beyond. What about 1 Peter? And that's a beautiful color a picture of a codex, and it's not a book roll, but a codex, which seems to be the preferred way of writing the early church, what eventually would become the book in today's form. But there's an early picture of it dating to the late 3rd century. The authorship of 1 Peter is widely accepted. The work is quoted or alluded to in the Epistle of Barnabas, which is a second century work. Barnabas, it's virtually 100% unanimity here. Barnabas had nothing to do with this writing. Writing probably composed around 130. And also, writing from about the same period of time, Polycarp's letter to the Philippians. So 1 Peter is known and quoted in the first third or so of the second century. It's also quoted and named by Irenaeus in his tract against heresies. Irenaeus was writing around the year 180. It's recognized, 1 Peter is, by Eusebius. But not so with 2 Peter. And here's an example of Papyrus 72, which shows a couple of pages of 2 Peter. The authorship of 2 Peter is rejected explicitly by Eusebius. It's ignored by most of the major theologians, and in fact, it appears to be, I know it is debated, but the majority view, I think it's safe to say, is that it's viewed as an expansion of the letter of Jude, which we'll come to right now. And there is an early papyrus, just a small portion of Jude, Papyrus 78. That's actually a flip side, so you're seeing the front side and then the back side, or what papyrologists call recto and verso. Well, the authorship of Jude, Yehuda, or Judah, is rejected by Eusebius. Of course, it was understood as claiming to be authored by none other than the brother of James, and therefore the brother of Jesus. However, Clement of Alexandria, writing right around the year 200 or so, at least according to Eusebius, who quotes him, Clement of Alexandria quotes Jude and apparently accepts its authenticity. Tertullian, writing about the same time, perhaps a decade earlier, apparently knows of a Latin translation of Jude and so cites it, at least we may infer, with approval. It is quoted several times by Polycarp, Barnabas, and Origen, Origen writing in the early 3rd century, and in fact in a number of places in his commentaries on Matthew and John, as well as his homilies on Ezekiel. It's used as a major source by the author of 2 Peter. Whether we accept Petrine authorship of 2 Peter or not, the fact that the author of 2 Peter depends so heavily on Jude and expands it, much as Paul expands, for example, his own letter, Colossians, in the circular letter, Ephesians, would suggest that the author of 2 Peter recognizes the authority of Jude. Now, here's what I want you to look at, and I hope you can see it clearly enough. And I want this chart to appear in the book that will come out of this. Now, study that for a moment. I'm gonna read to you some interesting statistics as you look at that. What you're looking at, beginning in canonical order, so look at the top on the left, it's Matthew, and then we work our way down, and then we move over to the right and finish Paul's letters, and we go on down on the right side, down to the bottom, to the book of Revelation. Now, you'll notice that there are two columns of numbers following the New Testament writing. So after Matthew is 23, and that's the total number of papyri. Now, before the book is published, it'll be necessary to make sure this is current, because every year, it seems, a new papyrus is discovered and published. And papyri happen to be our earliest, with some exceptions, our earliest textual witnesses to the writings of the New Testament. So these are very important. If you're at all interested in the debate that Bart Ehrman generated a few years ago with his book, Misquoting Jesus, then you'll want to know this kind of stuff, and you want to know it well. And of course, the question is how far back can we go? The autographs, the original writings produced in the second half of the first century are gone. So the question is how long did these autographs last? How early are the copies of them? How careful were the copies made? So that by the time we get to the late second century, and especially on into the third century, the 210s, 20s, two 40s in through there, where we have substantial portions of the Greek New Testament preserved. The question then is how close are these early copies, how close is their wording to the originals that were produced about 150 or so years earlier? That's the question, and that's why these statistics are rather important. And I'll tell you right now, the textual evidence is very good. We have a couple hundred manuscripts that predate the time of Constantine, before there could be any suggestion of tampering with the text from higher powers. That's the nonsense, of course, that's trotted out by Dan Brown and some other popular writers. And so the Greek New Testament is rather well established in our extant record. You can go to museums and you can go to libraries, you can go to the Sackler Papyri Room at Oxford, and you can see these texts, and they're very close and numerous, so that we have reasons to believe that we really do have something exceedingly close to the autographs. But there's another reason that this is important. What you're looking at here is just, it's like taking a poll. It's like taking a sample. And so we know we only have a sample, and yes, it tilts heavily in the direction of Egypt, which is where almost all of our papyri survive, and it's just the perfect weather conditions for it, the dry sands of Egypt. Some of you know the story of Oxyrhynchus, where in the 1890s, two British papyrologists and archaeologists went to Egypt for that very purpose, to find ancient papyri. In the 19th century, scholars were in the early stages of appreciating papyri and recognizing that these represented for us our earliest samples of Christian scripture. And so they began their work in Egypt with not much success, and finally they tried Oxyrhynchus, and they wandered out into an area, providentially found themselves standing on what was at one time the city dump covered with sand, and sticking out of the sand was a page of papyrus. And one of these Brits just kicked it, and it flipped over, and it was Matthew chapter 1. And it was like, providentially, it was like, okay, here you go, start digging right here. Very first chapter of the very first book of the New Testament. And what you may not know is that over the next several years, there were seven seasons of digs, hiring dozens and sometimes hundreds of locals. They dug down 30 feet. That's how deep the dump was. And in the first 10 feet down from the surface, the manuscripts were in remarkably excellent condition. And that was good, because the first 10 feet or so was basically the Christian period of time. The deeper you go, this is a general rule of thumb in archaeology, and it relates to what's called stratigraphy. The deeper down you go, the earlier, further back in time you go. And Oxyrhynchus was a city that was established in the 4th century B.C. and the Alexandrian period of time, when Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East and Greek became an important language. And so we have Greek documents that reach back to Alexander's time or shortly thereafter, on through into the New Testament period and beyond until the Islamic conquest. So there are hundreds of years worth of city dump with papyri. And so digging down about 10 feet, they finally began to get to sand and debris that was moist because of the seepage of a nearby canal. And then the manuscripts from that point on were in very poor condition. And they recovered very little of the manuscript treasures at that point on down. In fact, they came back later and most of it had been scooped up and used as fertilizer and potting mix by locals in their farms and gardens. But the manuscripts that could be recovered and could be read, they were mostly recovered from the top 10, 12 feet or so. Do you know how many manuscripts they recovered? 500,000. Yeah. And we've published at most about 10%. So we have another 400 and some thousand to go. We need volunteers. You spend about 10 years to become really good at Greek, and then you go to work at minimum wage. So that's why it's hard to find. Well, maybe it's a little better than minimum wage, but it's why it's tough to find volunteers. So there's a lot of work to be done. And along the way, we find Christian writings. And some of our very earliest, well, of course, our very earliest have come from Egypt. P52, a fragment of John's Gospel, John 18, is dated to about 130 or 140. Next year, the world will be stunned to learn that a very, very old fragment of Mark has been found. And it could date to the first century. And that'll have to wait for next year. But what I'm interested right now in this chart is just simply counting the manuscripts. When you look at Matthew, you see that there are 23 total papyri that have been found. These are older than the great codices that were produced deep into the Byzantine period and beyond, on into the Middle Ages. These are papyri, some of them a fragment of Matthew, a few small fragments, P64, date to perhaps as early as 180, 160 to 180 in the second century. And so right next to 23 on Matthew, you see the number 11. So just make sure you understand what you're looking at. We have 23 total papyri for Matthew, and 11 of them are early, and that is second or third century. When we go down to Mark, look at Mark, only three. It's going to be four pretty soon. And early, only one. It's going to be two pretty soon. And we go down to Luke, and it's 10, and then 6, and John is 30 and 19. So it's pretty obvious when you look at the Gospels, Matthew and John, at least in Egypt, were the really popular Gospels. Now go on down to Acts, and that's not too surprising. The book of Acts was treasured and recognized as a very important work. Not only is it the second volume to Luke, but also it tells the story of the early church and places the apostles in the post-gospel context as the early church unfolds and spreads throughout the Roman Empire. And then you look at Paul's letters, and you might not be surprised that we have 10 papyri for Romans, 5 that are early, 8 for 1 Corinthians, 3 that are early, but look how the numbers quickly shrink. 4 for 2 Corinthians, 2 for Galatians, 3 for Ephesians, 3 for Philippians, 2 for Colossians, 4 for 1 Thessalonians, 2 for 2 Thessalonians, none for 1 and 2 Timothy, 2 for Titus, 2 for Philemon. Now, do you see something change? Hebrews 8, James 6, 1 Peter 3, 2 Peter 2, 1 John 2, 1 and 1. I'm not going to talk about the Johannines. Jude 3. In other words, if all we had to go on was simply the survival of manuscripts as an indicator of which ones were being read. And popularity, I know we have to be careful about this kind of statistic and not be too simplistic with it, but scholars do take these kinds of factors into account. Looking at this table would suggest that the general letters, the real obvious Jewish letters in the New Testament, the ones that are very concerned with things Jewish, writing to Jewish believers in Jesus, exhorting them and encouraging them to continue in the faith, edifying them as to what they should believe about Jesus the Messiah, that they fall behind Paul's most popular letters in a close second position. Hebrews is eclipsed only by Romans. Isn't that interesting? It ties 1 Corinthians. In fact, we could say Romans and 1 Corinthians are the only epistles in the New Testament that are out in front of the generals. The generals otherwise are right on the heels of Paul's two most important and most popular letters. And I find that very interesting just to look at that, because this gives evidence that in the early centuries of the church, we can't speak about the first century because we simply have no statistical evidence of any sort. But if we go on into the second century, second, third, and fourth centuries, then the general letters are right up there, neck and neck, with Paul himself. The leading general letters, Hebrews and James, in fact, ahead of all of Paul's letters, with the exception of the two big ones, Romans and 1 Corinthians. What does that suggest? I think the turning point was the fourth century. The turning point was the fourth century when Emperor Constantine, and he's not collating the New Testament, that silly phrase from Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. He didn't decide which gospels to put in the New Testament and so on. Of course not. But when the church was tolerated, the so-called Edict of Toleration at the beginning of the fourth century, and the prestige that the Roman emperor brought to the Christian movement, the fact that the Christian church was now a legal movement, and the bishops gathered and other leaders at Nicaea in 325, and of course other councils and conferences on into the fourth and on into the fifth centuries, I think the church began to swing in a very overt and Gentile direction, or non-Jewish direction. But up to that point, the general letters, these very overtly Jewish letters written to Jewish believers in Jesus, those letters held their own and were right up there with the other letters being read, especially in the eastern part of the empire where the Jewish population was so represented, but I think also in Italy, where there was a significant Jewish population as well. And it's not until the fourth century that I think the tide begins to turn and we begin to hear important voices, leading voices like Eusebius, saying things like, well, this letter is rejected, 2 Peter's rejected, or these letters are spoken against, Hebrews, James, and others, Jude, spoken against. And at that point, they begin to lose traction and lose ground. Now, they'd been around long enough, had been read widely enough, that it was impossible for them to drop out of the canon. And so even though there were those speaking against them, they were retained. But what happened was, compromise, as it were, they were pushed to the back of the bus. And that's what concerns me. How does this impact us, practically speaking? Well, I'm in my 34th year of teaching the Bible, teaching primarily New Testament. I have taught introduction many, many times. I've used a variety of New Testament introductions as textbooks. And you can see it, these writings, the ones on the right-hand column at the bottom, they usually get short shrift in terms of page count. They often get short shrift in terms of minutes of lecture time in classes. And so that's the problem, and that I think we can correct. And so when I introduce the New Testament and start talking about important doctrinal developments in the early church, I actually begin with James and Hebrews. I put them in their order that you have in the book of Acts. And so these are very early voices. And it's amazing how they correspond, too, with the speech of James, for example, that he gives in Acts chapter 15 when he gives advice as to how the Gentiles, there was a Gentile problem, you know, in the early church, and how to sort this out and how to figure out how the Gentiles could fit into this Jewish messianic movement. And so we have a lot of correlation then, the theology of Hebrews, the theology of James, the theology of 1 Peter and even 2 Peter, how it fits in with the early church, those first 20 years or so before the Pauline expression and of course, the success of the Gentile mission begins to overshadow everything else. In fact, that really is what it is. It's just the success of the mission to the Gentile world that swept with it, brought along with it, the Pauline letters. And of course, I don't mean to take anything away from Paul, And it just, you know, is it his fault that he did such a good job? Now, what about the, I'll say a few things and I'm finished. What do these letters tell us then about these important questions that our conference is concerned with these few days? Well, the general letters have a lot to say about the people of Israel. I like what Hebrews says, for example, in chapter 2, verse 11. He, referring to Jesus, is not ashamed to call them brothers. You know, that could be an extrapolation of Mark 3, where Jesus says, looks around at his disciples and says, here are my mother and my brothers. These are my disciples. These are the ones who hear the word of God and do it. There's a close kinship with the Messiah. The author of Hebrews refers to the seed of Abraham. This is family we're talking about. There's a closeness and an identification with the people of Israel in Hebrews. We have the same thing in James. How does he address these people? They are the 12 tribes in the diaspora, the dispersion. The presupposes the covenants of the Old Testament in his language. Let me advance to 1 Peter. The exiles, he says, the exiles of the diaspora. This is not Gentile talk. This is a Jewish writer writing to Jewish people. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. Second, the author of 2 Peter says, therefore, brothers, be the more zealous to confirm your call and election. The call and election is not in doubt. It is a call and election for God's people, the children, the descendants of Abraham. Jude likewise writes, to those who are called, beloved in God the Father. There is a Jewish understanding throughout these letters, and it extends to the very people to whom they are writing. Now, there isn't much, if anything, directly about the land of Israel. However, I suggest the typology of rest in Hebrews presupposes the land of Israel. Otherwise, the typology wouldn't work. And the grumblers in the wilderness didn't enter the land. Don't let that happen to you. God has brought his salvation in a special way in his Son, not in some ordinary prophet, not through some priest, but in a unique and special Son. And he demonstrated his claims through his miraculous works and, of course, in his resurrection. Don't be like your forefathers in the wilderness. And I could go on and say similar things in some of these other writings. 1 Peter speaks of the inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, unfading. There is a future for Israel that these writings talk about. But I spent a lot of the time at the beginning of my talk because it's important that we defend these writings, their place in the canon, and I don't mean just in the canon, but move them up a little bit to the left, a little closer to the book of Acts, because they were foundational for the early church. We don't want to overlook them and let them be overpowered by Paul. Well, I come to a conclusion now simply to say, yes, there is a future, very much so. Israel in the land is a presupposition. A future for Israel is also assumed and declared in various ways in these important writings. I'm sorry about going through some of this very hastily, but we do have a tight schedule. And the whole paper, of course, in due course, will appear in the book. The PowerPoint slides themselves, complete with those pictures, are available on a flash drive, if that's of interest to you, there in the book room. And the book people encourage me to say that. I guess they want plenty of business, so you can run out there and get it. But there are 15 PowerPoint presentations on it, an entire course on Jesus and the Gospels. There are two video clips that talk about the apocryphal Gospels and also the Dead Sea Scrolls, and a number of documents, a bibliography for New Testament works and tools, as well as an exegesis guide, how to interpret Scripture and so on. It's a 4 gigabyte flash drive or pen drive, if you wish. Thank you very much.